Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.
Coming up on Weekend America.
When you're a talk show host and your audience is undocumented immigrants, you're on the spot.
I can't go on the air and advise people to break the law. On the other hand, I recognize hundreds of thousands of people in this community who are operating with false Social Security cards.
We'll go to Phoenix for Life on the Air with Alfredo Gutierrez. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. It's the last weekend of college football, and anything could happen.
When we started scoring, you could see the look on the Michigan fans' faces like, you know, what is this? What's going on? Why isn't our team? You know, we're expecting a victory.
You'll meet two drum majors who still can't believe what happened in Ann Arbor. And could you make it through the weekend without a cell phone?
Well, now I just walk down the street and I'm like Mary Poppins. I'm free as a bird. You know, and I'm allowed to be free as a bird.
Freedom's just another word for no one left to phone on Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota. This weekend in Arizona, some people are uneasy now that strict immigration laws have gone into effect.
Meanwhile, politics are heating up while much of the country shivers.
And welcome, Chicago. Listeners to WBEZ are joining us for the first time today.
So what is the perfect way to spend a cold winter weekend in Chicago?
You go to the bookstore, then you go to a blues club.
Probably go to the Hawks game.
Probably going down to Navy Pier.
Ice skating over at Millennium Park.
Go sledding.
You know, I love Chicago, but not January and February.
It's just brutally cold.
Hot chocolate, sitting with my cats, reading a book.
Drinking some hot cocos or a cocktail or whatever.
I would take a walking tour, an architecture tour of the city.
Outside in the cold?
Absolutely. Chicago Architecture Foundation, I'm a volunteer docent.
Very impressive. Very impressive.
Well, if you're less hardy, just take that bus tour. You can still see the buildings of Mies van der Rohe and Frank Lloyd Wright, minus the frostbite. Those voices came from Second City, the Windy City, and Chi-Town.
A new year means some new laws in effect this weekend. One of them is in Arizona, where as of January 1st, the state is cracking down on businesses that hire illegal immigrants. For many Arizona Hispanics who came here both illegally and legally, the law is yet another enforcement measure that can complicate their lives. Undocumented immigrants are limited, of course, in who they can talk to about their problems, but they do have one forum, a Spanish-language talk radio show called Aquí Estamos, We Are Here, hosted by Alfredo Gutierrez in Phoenix.
En la Escuela Peralta, que viene siendo allá en la 72 Avenida, y le encanto, a una vecindad, pues, hispana, latina, estaba en la escuela y hoy...
That's Alfredo talking about a community forum on immigration. His listeners also call in to share their stories and their fears. Alfredo estimates at least a third of them are undocumented. Alfredo, welcome to Weekend America.
Thank you.
So this new law that makes it illegal to hire undocumented workers, you've seen this law coming. Your governor signed it back in July. How have you been preparing your listeners?
One part of the conversation has been about whether people should leave or not, whether people should even return to their home country and go to another state. And our advice has been, if you have a stake in Mexico, if you have a stake in Guatemala, if you've got somewhere to go back to, then that's perhaps a viable alternative. But it's our perception that the overwhelming majority of our folks have neither of those options. They are here because they didn't and couldn't survive in Mexico and Guatemala. And they don't have options to go to another state. And so that's been the first piece of advice. If you don't have an option, then you have to begin to, we've talked about for months, save enough money to survive perhaps 3 or 4 months after the eventuality of this law. Because the eventuality, we believe, is going to mean certainly higher, if not massive, rates of unemployment within the Hispanic community.
Have you noticed any effects, even just in these few days, that you trace to this new law having taken effect?
No, I think it's too soon. I think the impact was in preparation for this law.
Mm-hmm.
And at this moment, everyone's waiting for the shoe to drop.
What do you mean by the shoe dropping?
I mean that we expect that raids are going to occur. There are hundreds of thousands of employers in Maricopa County and Phoenix and the surrounding areas. It's impossible for the sheriff and the county attorney to enforce this law in any uniform fashion. So they're going to take 6, 7, 8 employers to make an examples of them. And everyone awaits to see who they are and how they're going to be treated, what the tactics are that they're going to use. We believe that once they employ them, that will set the pattern for behavior and for adjustments in behavior, both of employers and of employees, that is, the Hispanic community.
Alfredo, what do your listeners tell you on the air that they don't tell the police and they don't say in other public places?
Oh, we talk a lot about crimes that haven't been reported. We have heard of sexual assaults. We've heard of robberies. We've heard of suspected drop houses, et cetera, on the air, where the individual involved simply is not going to call the authorities because they're not certain of who's going to show up. The other thing we're hearing about is we spend a lot of time talking about what do you do if the police stop you and you don't have a driver's license or you have a matricula consular, the identity card that's given to you by the Mexican consulate. Do you present it or not present it?
Mm-hmm. What responsibility do you feel, if any, to advise your listeners to follow the law and not to evade it?
Look, my responsibility to the community is to give them the best possible advice to reflect on all of the realities around us. I can't go on the air and advise people to break the law. On the other hand, I recognize, as should any reasonable person, that there are millions of people, there are hundreds of thousands of people in this community who are operating with false Social Security cards. And I can't deny that from as part of the reality of life. And so we tell people, look, if you've got this card, these are the actions that the government is going to take against you. Some might construe that to mean advice on how to evade the law. I construe it to mean advice on how to survive in this country until we can arrive at a set of legislation, a just immigration reform in this country.
Alfredo, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Alfredo Gutierrez, his show Aquí Estamos airs weekdays in the Phoenix area. You can link to his show through our website, weekendamerica.org.
Tonight, the presidential candidates on both sides will be debating in New Hampshire. They're going to try to say those magic words to win over voters in Tuesday's primary. Well, I hope that they took notes from the Iowa caucuses. That's where experts say that the caucus winners, Mike Huckabee and Barack Obama, were both able to attract a lot of single-issue voters. Well, Martin White was one of those voters. He's a hunter and a Huckabee supporter. For him, gun issues take precedence over everything else, which means all the speeches, the stumping, the persuasion, they're more or less a waste of his time.
For me personally, a lot of it was, absolutely. I had a pretty good idea with the candidates going in where they were on their issues and in particular the single issue that I'm most interested in, which is gun control. I'm very pro-Second Amendment. I don't support candidates that don't have the same views on the Second Amendment that I do.
Do you find yourself, as a single-issue voter, your concern is about guns, do you find yourself waiting to hear a candidate say the magic words?
Well, yeah, probably a little bit. And I guess those words are is that they basically spell it out without being wishy-washy about it, whether or not they support the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms.
So, Fred Thompson...
He said that, yes. He made that very clear.
And are there words you wish Huckabee had said that you could just be a little bit happier about your support of him?
You know, he probably didn't come out and make that any kind of a key issue, except that when a question directed to him about it, I felt that he clarified his position on it.
So, Martin, are you going hunting this weekend?
I plan to, yes, after some driving.
Well, good luck to you on your hunting trip this weekend.
Well, thank you.
Well, in Martin White's case, it all worked out. Huckabee won in Iowa. But will Huckabee have the same momentum in New Hampshire? Joining me now is Ed Sarpolis. He's vice president of Michigan Research Associates, and he analyzes voting trends and poll results. And he says that single-issue voting doesn't always help the candidate. Ed, welcome to Week in America.
Well, it's good to be on your show, Desiree.
Why are people single-issue voters?
They're single-issue voters because they actually believe in something, and it's something that they want resolved. It's something that's important. What's a key to single-issue voters, though, is that they're very prominent in primaries and less so in generals. People turn out on primary day tend to be much more the single-issue voters. So you got Romney running as a moderate in Massachusetts, now coming to Iowa and claiming that he was a hunter, shooting varmints. And you've got Mike Huckabee, who basically, because of the values piece, was able to overcome the issue that he raised taxes in Arkansas. And the problem being is in the case of Rudolph Giuliani, the ex-mayor of New York, he lost both on the issue of the abortion issue. He couldn't run on the gun issue. He doesn't have the value issues because of his poor choice issue and his multiple wives. So he had to sit out the election and end up maybe costing him the nomination on the Republican side.
Are single issues as salient on both sides? Do Democrats also have their issues?
Well, the Democrats have their issues, but they're not as dominant as they used to be in the 70s and the 80s. In the 70s and the 80s, the issue of choice and the abortion were very key to voters on the Democratic side.
I'm wondering if a single issue is beginning to emerge, however, with Obama coming out of the Iowa caucuses on top. Is something like change or unity, is that too amorphous to be a single issue?
No, because it's the code word for war. Barack Obama's success has been is that he is the change agent, not only for the war, but for things in general. He's a younger generation, bringing people together. And in the case of Hillary Clinton, she can't say she's the agent of change because she voted for the war. She supports some of the current policy. And so change is the new buzzword for Democrats' single issue, but it's a code word for many other things.
And so perhaps the trick for the candidate is to define a single issue that resonates but's also flexible enough that it's transportable from state to state, primary to primary.
That's the reason why Mike Huckabee feels very comfortable with the economic populism, because he can still keep his pro-gun message, he still can deal with his anti-immigration message, but he can focus on cultural conservatism, you know, very effectively and still appeal to those people who feel that there's a role for government in their lives.
Well, Ed, this is interesting. We'll have to check back with you as the primaries progress.
My pleasure.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Coming up, Barack and Huck, another special prosecutor, and a cocaine vaccine. Good news, bad news, no news, next on Weekend America. We'll be right back. You're listening to Weekend America from American Public Media. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. So last year you knew what was good news and bad news, but you're a different person now. It's a new year. You might have made a resolution that has you seeing things differently. Who knows? Let's bring in some friends to help us sort out the latest good, bad, and the non-news. Our panel this weekend is author Diana Abu-Jabbar. Welcome, Diana.
Hi there.
New Yorker cartoon editor Bob Mankoff. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
And writer-producer John Ridley. Hello, John.
I already pale in comparison. Hi. New Yorker cartoon editor. Yeah. Okay.
Sorry.
It's a lot easier than you think.
Our first topic, Iowa caucuses. You know the results. Do they feel like good news, bad news, or no news?
For me, there was sort of good news and bad news. I mean, the good news was Barack Obama, who I've been for way back since the beginning of the end of the Iowa vote tally. But the bad news was before that I was for Biden, and I can't believe he dropped out after he trounced Dodd.
Yeah, he really right. waxed Christopher Dodd down at the bottom.
We're number five.
Yeah. Others?
I have a lot of empathy for the candidates. You know, as a novelist, I feel like going to these caucuses and primaries is probably a lot like going on a book tour where, you know, you try to go across country and you hope somebody shows up and you have to arrange mm-hmm. babysitters for your audience and drive them there and stuff.
Gee, now I want to vote for you.
All right.
Yeah, you're empathetic. That's yeah. a good quality. John?
As a man of color, I'm very excited that Barack Obama did well and that he did well in Iowa and that I think that, you know, throughout most of the United States he'll do well. So I think that's good news. I think it's good news for all of us. I think it's good news for our country, regardless of what happens from here. People are ready to ignore race and vote in people who they believe in. I think also, unfortunately, I think it's bad news because on both sides, Huckabee and Obama, I think likability has trumped experience. I'm torn. What can I tell you? I'm not being helpful, but it's emotionally very good news. Intellectually, I'm a little concerned.
But remember also, you know, one of the things I really like is that he's skinny.
Right.
You know, he'll be the skinniest president we ever had. And people just completely ignore this.
And Huckabee made himself skinny.
Right. Well, I wouldn't call him skinny.
He can thin himself down more if that's what it takes.
Okay. Our next topic. The U.S. Justice Department has launched a formal criminal investigation into the destruction of CIA videotapes of prisoner interrogations. Is that good news, bad news, no news?
Well, I mean, for me, it was really bad news because so much of our fight against terrorism has to do with our supposedly superior technology. And here we're using tapes rather than Blu-ray or HD DVD.
Yeah.
I mean, this is ridiculous.
Ultimately, I think it's good because it really goes to the heart of the question of defending our security at the cost of our liberties. You know, how far are we prepared to take that? And you know, especially at a time when we hear the government talking about stuff like, you know, torture as enhanced interview techniques, you know, we really do need to start to look at our values and what we're allowing our government to do.
John?
I think it's no news. I mean, on the heels of the Whitewater investigation, the Plame investigation, the Mitchell report, it's going to be tens of millions of dollars to find out that 95% of the players don't use drugs, you know? I don't think it's news. We have these big investigations. A lot of money is spent, and nothing generally comes of them. And it tends to be a waste and a distraction from what's really going on, which is right in front of us, and we all know.
But don't you think it'd be interesting to see what interrogation techniques the Justice Department might be allowed to use?
The Justice Department and finding out what the truth is.
I mean, on the CIA guys.
The Justice Department's coercive techniques for finding out what happened to those
interrogation tapes? They didn't think it was torture, so it should be perfectly all right to waterboard the CIA guys.
They have Dick Cheney.
Our next topic. Scientists are developing a cocaine vaccine. It blocks the drug's effect in your body. Good news, bad news, no news.
Bad news if you're a rock star.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
What's the point of being a rock star anymore?
I don't know. I think it's no news because these are the stories that always come out where they're going to pose 100 dilemmas, philosophical dilemmas. Uh-huh. Can we proactively, if they develop, and then they never develop this stuff.
Yeah, you're referring to the bad. There are several bad news scenarios. Parents inoculating their kids against their little wills. Courts making the vaccine a condition for a lighter sentence, which some people say is coercive. Your employer finds out about your habit through your prescription records. Pregnant women forced to get a shot to protect their fetus.
Those aren't all bad things, though.
Not necessarily bad. Depends on your point of view.
Yeah.
I think it's great, actually. I want a chocoholic patch, you know, so that you can. Is that in the foreseeable future?
I think the woman who wrote the cartoon Kathy is developing a chocoholic vaccine.
I just, you know, to me, it's like everything else. Let's take care of cancer. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't even believe that this sort of, it gets a bleed off funding. You know, again, this is sort of, it's a socioeconomic kind of thing. We got to take care of a certain strut. Oh, look, we got the cocaine. You know, oh, look, we have a cure for champagne hangovers. We'll take care of that as well. Oh, what, too much caviar? And you're not feeling too well? Well, we got a little pill for that as well. But take care of stuff that's really affecting people. And not, yeah, it's just, it seems like a waste of good research brains.
Well, the way they do it, of course, is they call it a scourge.
A scourge.
You know?
So is that, do you get that? I think it's no news. Did that come through in my sarcasm?
You're pro-scourge.
I can't believe it was a topic. That's what I'm saying.
Wow. Now it's a personal attack. You are so hopped up right now.
I was going to run my negative cocaine antidote ad, but I'm pulling it. I'm not going to go negative with that ad. I will display it for the media, but other than that, I'm just going to get rid of it.
Yes, this is a Huckabee reference.
Right.
Yeah, thank you.
Why do you have to explain it?
Because not everybody follows the campaign you do.
Then they're not listening to Weekend America.
No?
No.
You know, I made a lot of references to Wittgenstein, the philosopher, but nobody brings that up.
No, that's true.
Nobody has any, you know.
Because all your New Yorker cartoon-reading people are just cracking up. They're rolling on the floor. They're still on the first bit. They haven't even gotten this far yet.
They're still peeing their pants over the Hegelian bit.
Oh, this is getting ugly.
Yeah.
But in a super intellectual fashion.
Yes. Right. Panel, that's the news. Thank you so much. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, everybody.
Oh, John, it sounded like you just died.
Because I was happy when I started, and then everybody said, oh, why are you so happy? What's up with you? Oh, Barack Obama's winning. Now all you people are so excited. Yeah, you're taking over the world.
Right.
I felt I had to tear you. Suddenly you felt like a threat to me, John. I don't know. Just psychologically, it was weird. I don't know what happened.
People are just coming up to me all day. You still got to get through Texas, pal. Still got to get through Alabama.
Oh, wow.
I know. And that's in my own house. I haven't left the house yet today.
Oh, ow.
I'll do it again. Hey, thanks, Bill and panel. Happy New Year.
Sweet. John Ridley has an NPR blog called Visible Man, and his latest book, The American Way, is a graphic novel about a government-created team of superheroes. Diana Abu-Jabra's new novel is Origin, in which a forensic scientist tries to explain a spike in the number of local SIDS deaths. Bob Mankoff edits and sometimes creates the cartoons at The New Yorker. And you can cast your own good, bad, no news votes on these issues at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
Do you use a cell phone, or does it use you? You'll meet a man trying to lose the phone without losing his friends, coming up on Weekend America. From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota. For many people, turning 30 is all about pressure.
Yes, pressure to marry, pressure to get a real job, pressure to start a family. Well, in 1960, about 70% of all American 30-year-olds had done those things. But in 2000, less than 40% hit those milestones.
And experts say that those 20-somethings are not a bunch of slackers. It's just that it's harder to reach those goals these days. When New Yorker Jim McNeil turned 29 last March, she wanted to achieve something very different before she turned 30. Every day for a year, she wanted to do at least one new thing. And so I asked her how she decided what she'd try.
I had a list of things that I sort of decided in my early 20s that I wanted to have accomplished by the time I was 30. And that included getting a master's degree, moving to New York, falling in love, and starting a career in journalism. And I did all that by the time I was 28. And when I started thinking about things I could do before I turned 30, I thought, why do they all have to be big things? You know, why do I have to go to Europe or go skydiving or these big things? And it can just be small things that maybe other people have done on a regular basis, but I have never experienced before. So it has to be something that I had never done.
I noticed there were some things that you did that kind of fall into the category of reclaiming childhood, maybe. Mm-hmm. Dyeing your foot purple, playing jacks,
yeah.
Wearing a lampshade on your head to a party where no one was drunk, including yourself.
Right.
What's that about?
I mean, how many people have things that they wanted to do when they were children that they never got to do, either because they weren't able to or they weren't allowed to, or it was just out of the question? So this is a lot of these things are stuff that I wanted to do when I was a kid. Like the 100th day of doing this, I celebrated by eating junk food for an entire day. Like literally, like I had jelly beans for breakfast.
When you actually reach back to childhood and do some things as you're approaching 30, what perspective do those activities bring to your life?
I sort of tried to imagine how I would have felt accomplishing those things if I was actually, you know, 8 years old. One thing I did was I rolled myself up in a rug, and I don't know why I thought that was a good idea as a child, and it was fun. It was just one of those like weird, silly things where when I was done, I was like, great, now I did that, moving on, you know, and if I was a child, I probably would have tried to do it every day if I thought it was so great, you know. Even if it's stuff that's not particularly devious, there's just that rush of adventure. You know, when you're a kid, it's like maybe you're more afraid to try things, or maybe it's just not possible. And to have not only the physical ability, but sort of the wherewithal and, you know, a better understanding of how to do something as an adult, combined with that sort of latent rush that I would have gotten when I was 5, that's kind of an awesome combination.
If you had not chosen to do this consciously, is it something that unconsciously every person can, like, sit down at 10:30 or 11 at night and say, you know what I did today? I actually put peppers on my tuna sandwich. And I didn't think about that, but that was a new thing.
With the course of this project in that context, there's been days when maybe I haven't consciously gone out of my way to do something new, but I realized at the end of the day that, oh, I took a walk with my neighbor today and I'd never even met her before, you know. So things like that have ended up in the blog, but there's just certain things I wanted to seek out and do.
Why start this at 29 and end it at 30? It seems like there would be a temptation to, when you're turning that milestone at 30, it seems like there would be a temptation to counterbalance that by saying, you know what, no, I'm going to do something new. I'm going to grab life starting at 30.
I've always thought of 29 as sort of the jumping off point, whereas I've thought of 30 as a destination or a place to arrive at. I think of it sort of like graduating high school, where maybe people are depressed and sad about finishing high school, even though they know that they're going on to something even bigger and better. So it was more like I was celebrating the end of my 20s and then can go into my 30s and be like, look at everything I've accomplished.
Jen, well, thank you and good luck with the rest of your list.
Thank you so much. Happy New Year.
Jen missed out on Talk Like a Pirate Day last September, but that's not going to stop her from participating. Tomorrow, she's going to walk around New York City wearing an eye patch all day. You want to try it too? Well, we've got a link to Jen's blog on our website. That's weekendamerica.org. Get some ideas or just live vicariously.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
Welcome to the radio show about the American weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. So if you are still sticking to your New Year's resolution, congratulations to you. Warmest congratulations. You have only about 12 months to go now. However, if you are wobbly at all, the weekend is often your downfall. This is the time. You don't have your weekly routine to settle into. You've got the Saturday night temptations. You've got the empty Sundays waiting to be filled with resolution failure. So it's a very treacherous time. This next story is about somebody who has made a New Year's resolution that he hopes to stick to for life. Aaron Kiley is a poet, an archivist, and he's the best friend of Weekend America reporter Sean Cole.
I stayed with Aaron in Brooklyn over New Year's.
How long before I got home did you get here?
Minutes.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I actually called, but...
But you couldn't reach me because I don't have a cell phone. See how much it comes up?
The fact that he's a New Yorker is important. This is, of course, a city where everybody, all the time, is transforming their cell phones into yell phones.
It's on 2nd Street. Okay.
Which is one of the reasons that Aaron's done with mobile technology.
So just trying to get out of that fast-pacedness and that distraction and making all adults, like, sort of act like 13-year-old bumblebees who don't know who to talk to next and, you know, that sort of thing. So...
And he has three other reasons. One, it's expensive, and he and his girlfriend are already paying for a landline. Two, possible health effects. And three, and this is the most important one, gorillas.
This is what I've read. The coltan is the metal that is used in making cell phones. And it's only mined a few places in the world or something like that. And one of the main places is the Congo. And the only place to get it is where the gorillas are living, in the jungle. So locals are, you know, killing gorillas.
Destroying their habitat, and also shooting and eating them. So after reading that, when his cell phone company said, "We're cutting you off for non-payment," he just let it go. That was about 3 months ago, and life has gotten a lot better, he says.
Overall, it's been great, and it's sort of let me not feel guilty for not being contacted. When now I just walk down the street, and it's, I'm like Mary Poppins. I'm free as a bird. You know, and I'm allowed to be free as a bird. I'm allowed to not be interrupted.
Whereas I am constantly being interrupted. Or at least it seems that way, now that Aaron isn't anymore.
Hi, this is Christine Rosen. This is my cell phone, which I do not check frequently, so if you want to...
Christine Rosen is a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and editor of The New Atlantis, a journal of technology and society. She also was very excited to actually use her cell phone for work.
I'm telling you, I almost never conduct any official business on it. It's almost never on.
About 3 years ago, Rosen wrote an article called "Our Cell Phones, Ourselves," about how mobile communication is changing our behavior.
When everybody is either without cell phones or everybody is with cell phones, the norm shifts occur with a little less friction. But when you're the odd man out, I mean, it's like the kids who don't join Facebook. They're pariahs on college campuses.
Exactly.
And we haven't really even had this technology that long, but it has been so powerfully and enthusiastically adopted by our culture that to say no to it is really dramatic.
People are sort of shocked, sort of like, a look comes over their face like, wow, like...
It's almost become an appendage for some people.
You've sort of dropped, like, a limb that you use all the time.
Or a kind of psychic leash. His girlfriend, Kish, who has never had a cell phone and who wanted him to get rid of his, found herself having little jealous worries when he was out of the house, as if the cell phone was a kind of promise ring. His mom, Cheryl, told me she's going to try to talk him into getting one again.
What do you think he'll say?
Oh, I'll use all the, you know... What if I needed you? What if you needed me?
So you're going to guilt him, basically.
Yeah.
But most of the complaints come from someone else.
So what? Who gives you the most
Ian.
Ian Bassetta, friend of ours.
He said I gave him about it?
He lives in Brooklyn, too.
For not having a I jokingly have said it, yeah.
But you don't mean it?
No. I mean, yeah, moment. Okay, wait, I should take that back. Do I mean it? Yeah, like, I mean it a little bit. Like, when he's like, when we can't meet up, I'm like, why don't you have a freaking cell phone? I have given him shit, yeah.
And for good reason.
Okay, here's something weird. He asks to borrow my cell phone. That is huge. That really pisses me off.
He hit me up, too.
I keep dialing and dialing, and I either misdial or it doesn't go through.
I was interviewing my colleague, Elisa Roth, about her recurring cell phone nightmare.
Are you on the plane when this is happening?
No, no, I'm watching the plane crash, and I want to call and report it, and I can't.
Restricted. Hi, it's Sean. Oh, hey. Oh, you're calling from a payphone. That's why it says restricted. Oh, he's calling from the desk of the building I'm in.
Aaron said he needed my cell phone for something. And when I handed it to him down in the lobby, he said, I'll let you know when I'm done. And I said, wait, how will you get a hold of me?
I can't figure this out. I think that you should come up to the eighth floor.
Eighth floor as a visitor.
Right, so what you have to do
is... It's like renting a car but not owning one. You know, maybe we can minimize how much we need them.
Or it's like saying, cigarettes are so bad for you, I would never buy them. Can I have one of yours?
Sure, but still it's using it less than I would if I had one, and that's good for something in the world.
Of course, those of us who know Aaron just find his chutzpah endearing. The trickiest parts of his cell phone-free life are things that used to be so easy before we all had cell phones. Just going out to dinner, like he and Ian planned to do at the Cafe Orland sometime before Christmas.
We were supposed to meet at a given time.
He was late, and so I went outside to call him on a payphone, and I got him, and he said,
I'm driving around Manhattan, stuck in traffic.
So then I went back into the cafe and waited for a while, but then almost another hour went by, and I realized, well, something's wrong, you know.
I actually think I called the Orland. I tried to call the Orland.
So then I called him again, but then I couldn't get through to him.
I think I tried calling back the payphone.
And then I called him another 20 minutes later or something and finally got him. And
he's like, you're late. I've been here I've eaten and drank already.
And I was a little pissed, but I was actually concerned because I thought he might have gotten a car accident or something. And he said,
I've just gotten pulled over by a police officer for running a red light because I was on my cell phone.
And though that night was really harrowing, Ian said he had a little spark of delight, too. Having to rely on himself instead of his phone.
I had to get there now. I had to make the effort to actually go there. I was just going to give up and say, forget this. This is insane. But I thought, no, I got to go meet him, you know, no matter what.
He says he's even started thinking about giving up his own phone. Of course, he's also thinking about getting one of those iPhones.
I'm continuing to be fairly pessimistic about
Are you?
How we've integrated these devices into our lives.
Yeah. This is Christine Rosen again. So, I mean, what can we do?
Take a break, even if it's just a weekend. Just put the cell phone down and see what life is like without it for a weekend.
Hello? Hello? I lost her. And every morning, I kind of lose Aaron, too. Briefly, in between home and work, when he's out getting coffee and walking around. It's like I'm the Wicked Witch of the West looking at him in my crystal ball. I can see him, but I can't reach him. He says he sometimes feels the same way.
Just today, yesterday, I wanted to call you and just, it was some joke I wanted to tell you about or something, and I couldn't do it, you know, but...
What was it?
I forget, but, you know...
See, you forgot!
But it's a joke! Do I need to kill a gorilla to tell you a joke?
No, but you don't know what it is now. Like, what if it wasn't a joke? What if it was something more important?
I do want to be in contact if there's some sort of emergency, something really important I need to be in contact for. But with my life, I don't need that. I'd like to be a part of a culture where there's a bunch of people who don't have cell phones. And there's a bunch of people who do, who really need them. And it's good for one of every troop to sort of just say, hey, guess what? We don't have to, you know. I didn't, like, grow a long beard and become a caveman because I threw away my cell phone, you know.
And when I think about it, we've actually been more in touch since he stopped using the phone. And this month, after 7 years in New York, he's moving back to Boston, where I'll get to see him all the time. In Boston, I'm Sean Cole for Weekend America.
You know, the sequel to this story, however, is going to be, if you heard about cities are phasing out payphones, so Aaron is losing his lifelines.
Exactly, and it makes me nervous to hear that. You know, Christine Rosen, who was cited in the story, she was the expert, she's written an article, and she says the main reason people get cell phones is because of security. And I'm afraid for this guy, you know, no cell phone, he's not tethered to anything. And as a parent, I've needed cell phones to call kids, I'm going to be late, wait for me here, that kind of thing. So, you know, I think I can't imagine life without a cell phone.
But you're talking about fear, Des, and in this article, which, by the way, we link to at our website, Christine Rosen talks about, does security equal paranoia, though? If you know, for
maybe. I mean, there is that issue of helicopter parents who, like, lowjack their kids through the cell phone. They can trace wherever mm-hmm. they are, their every move, or kids lie and say their cell phone died so they can go anywhere they want. But I think the bottom line is it still is very much a security thing for people, practically speaking.
Well, I was really interested in this article about the evolution of etiquette. As a bus commuter myself, how do I know that my right to silence trumps this guy's right to talk, and is that going to evolve over time? And we have a link to that article at our website, as well as an article about the other subject mentioned, coltan and gorillas, the mining of metals in Africa. You can find out more about that at our website, too, weekendamerica.org.
Iguanas were falling from the trees during a cold snap in Florida this week.
I heard that.
Yeah, but they should be able to hang on better this weekend because temperatures are bouncing back to the 70s. So for more weather, here's Week in America's John Moe.
Many people see fruitcake as a holiday tradition they'd just as soon toss out. Folks in Manitou Springs, Colorado feel that way too, but for different reasons. They're holding the annual Great Fruitcake Toss, hucking the weird loaves for distance under sunny skies and 51 degrees. Afterwards, pick them up, dust them off, slap on a bow. Christmas 2008 is covered. A chilly night in Jacksonville with showers and 59. That's chilly by Florida standards. Minnesotans are shaking their heads right now. But dogs are just happy to be with their people at the Dog Scouts campout. Learn techniques in dog camping and dog canoeing and kayaking. Meanwhile, cats are like camping in the rain and then getting in a boat. Wow, have fun with that. Forecast for Memphis, 57 degrees, showers, hound dogs crying all the time, heartbroken hotels, and wardens throwing parties in county jails. It's the annual Elvis birthday celebration with dance parties, tours, and ceremonies. If a mysterious figure in mutton chop sideburns lurks in the background, just let him be. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
You're surrounded by 100,000 screaming people who know you're going to fail. If they're wrong, it might change your life. That's next on Weekend America. This is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper on the last weekend of college football, GMAC Bowl tomorrow in Alabama, and the season ends Monday with the national championship in New Orleans. This has arguably been the most unpredictable season ever, and the surprises started immediately on September 1st when tiny Appalachian State University traveled from Boone, North Carolina to Ann Arbor to play the winningest team in college football history, the University of Michigan. Everyone knew Appalachian would get slaughtered. The Las Vegas odds makers didn't even cover the game. Only a handful of Appalachian fans were even there that day. But the band was, and two of its drum majors, Jeff Lazenby and Cameron Radford, take us back.
Going in the stadium, there were 107,000 people, and here was this 300-piece band that was ready to take on the entire stadium if we needed to. So we kind of dubbed ourselves the 300.
It was actually, I think it came over the Jumbotron that that was the highest attendance in a college football game.
Here we go. The college football season underway in Ann Arbor.
I've never sat at a football game in this particular spot. They had our band in bleachers down on the field, on the sidelines.
I was standing conducting, and somebody was talking to me, and then all of a sudden somebody screamed, and I turned around, and as I turned around, a football was headed right towards my head. It was like being like right there with the football team, like we were on the field with them, trying to pull us towards a victory.
First and goal for the Wolverines on this their first possession of the season, and they're going to try to get Hart to the end zone. He done.
Starting in the first quarter after the kickoff, Michigan ran down, and they scored on their opening drive. And to me, that only affirmed my belief that today was going to be a rough day for the Appalachian football team.
What's our chances against beating Michigan, you know, the big dog?
However, when our team turned right back around and scored on our opening drive, all of a sudden, I just realized, wow, if we can score on our opening drive against Michigan, maybe, just maybe, there's some hope for us after all.
Good snap, good hold, and we are tied at 7. The Mountaineers walking into the big house.
We weren't quite sure if perhaps that first touchdown we got was more or less a fluke. And then all of a sudden we scored 3. And so the 300 of us against the 107,000 Michigan fans were going absolutely crazy.
And they are jumping up and down and celebrating on the Appalachian State sideline and in the crowd, and wouldn't you?
During the second quarter, when we started scoring, you could see the look on the Michigan fans' faces like, you know, what is this? What's going on? Why isn't our team? You know, we're expecting a victory. And I think that was the one thing. They expected it. And that was one thing to our advantage, that we could come in and, you know, be the unexpected.
This stadium, with over 107,000 in it, you could almost hear a whisper.
There was an entire section of Michigan fans directly behind us that at the beginning of the game had been really laying it to the band, telling us how we were going to lose. And by the end of the second quarter, after we had scored the touchdowns, those fans had taken a seat and were rather quiet, while the 300 of us were going crazy, playing the fight song.
I remember one time I was standing over on the sideline, and our director, Dr. Tobias, I looked at him, and I was like, can you believe this? It was unreal that we were sitting in a stadium where, you know, so much history has happened, and our football team is pulling ahead, and we are just really, you know, sticking it to Michigan.
And we open the fourth quarter on a first down carry by Richardson. He's spun to the ground by Sean Crable. 31-26 in front of Appalachian State.
The last 5 minutes of that football game were some of the most intense and unpredictable minutes in a game I have ever seen in all of any high school, college, or even professional football.
And, I mean, it was just back and forth between the two teams. You know, they would score, put points on the board. We would score, put points on the board.
Back and forth, blocked field goals, things I hadn't seen before, and it all came down to the very end.
They were on like the 30-yard line and about ready to kick a field goal and just put in the game with a victory for Michigan. And then all of a sudden,
good snap, good hold, and the kick is blocked. Appalachian State has stunned the college football world, one of the greatest upsets in sports history.
When that happened, because I had already prepared myself to lose, I didn't quite know what to think. And it probably took a minute or two for the realization to sit in of what had just happened. And then all of a sudden it was just like, we won. It went to show the nation that it didn't matter who was considered the best or biggest
it was those that had the desire and the determination and the teamwork and cooperation that could come out on top.
I can say I was there for the biggest upset in college football history. And to be able to tell people, you know, later on that I was a part of that and kind of feel like I helped, you know, bring the team a victory and bring so much recognition to our school, it's just something that I will hold with me forever.
It will literally affect who I am and what I believe can be achieved and can be done for the rest of my entire life and career.
You had to bring it up, Bill. You just had to bring it up.
Sorry, Michigander. That was music education major Jeff Lazenby and history secondary education major Cameron Radford, two Appalachian State drum majors. The Mountaineers went on to win their third straight FCS title, the Football Championship Subdivision. As for Michigan, well, head coach Lloyd Carr announced his retirement 2 days after the season ended. You can learn more. Des won't, but you can at weekendamerica.org. That's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America, produced with Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Neely Allel, Millie Jefferson, Sam Keenan, Michael Rayfield, Susie Lechtenberg, and Tim Bomba.
Also, Johnny Vince Evans, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Noonan, Phyllis Owens, Angela Kim, John Moe, and Mark Sanchez.
Our theme music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. You can get a free podcast and take us with you. Just go to our website, weekendamerica.org. Great to have you with us. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Hey, get out there and enjoy your weekend.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. This program is made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
This is Bill Radke, host of Weekend America. The weekends are for courage.
Yeah, when you come in here and you see a whole bunch of people in there, hey, they go Pookie, they go Mikey. You know, I didn't expect to see him here. It make you kind of feel like, okay, well, if they're going to do it, then I can do it.
Conquering errands, braving to-do lists, listening to the most memorable stories and ideas every Saturday. Weekend America. Join us.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.